ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
This August, Science Week is blooming around the ABC.
Flowers don't usually inspire fierce competition.
Unless you're asking Australians to pick their favourites.
This Science Week, we're celebrating Australia's wildflowers.
Vote now for Australia's favourite at abc.net.au/science.
Celebrate Science Week with us in August on ABC Radio National and at abc.net.au/science.
Is it worth the abuse?
Now, that's the question that women in public life around the world are asking themselves increasingly.
Yes, Geraldine, because a new wave of research says that the abuse of women in public life has been supercharged by AI and it has far-reaching consequences.
I'm Geraldine Doogue, and on this episode, are online trolls harming our democracy?
And I'm Latika Burke. Geraldine, let's go roaming.
Now, Latika, we're taking a bit of a different approach on this episode of Global Roaming because we're looking at the wave of research around the world that shows a rise in the abuse of women in public life. And the suggestion is that there could be alarming implications for female representation in democracy. Now, I have to honestly admit, I've often said to people, just don't go there, Latika, because I'm not a great user of social media. I just say, leave it. Don't engage with those pathetic people. Just stay off it. Now, I'm an older person. I'm not as young and engaging with social media. You're much more, I think, in that demographic. Do you notice it getting worse?
Absolutely. I am absolutely a social media native. I'm not sure that I could ever take myself off it. And I don't want to either, because I think you miss what is happening in the online world. I've got to say, over Christmas, when I was scrolling through X and started seeing men say, "Grok, hey, what does she look like with no clothes on? Mm-hmm. Hey, Grok, put her in a bikini." Now, Grok is Elon Musk's AI tool on X, formerly known as Twitter. And what you were seeing take place was any woman that said anything, a bunch of guys would jump on and say, "Oh, let's undress her." And then you'd have what were fake photos, but with a very real-looking image of whoever it was, a woman obviously, either naked or in very skimpy clothing. Now, that to me was horrifying. That is a real silencing, chilling effect, because nobody needs to know if that image is real or not. Once it's out there, it's out there. It's like a digital tattoo. And if someone is maliciously and malevolently able to create that in a matter of seconds, because tech has enabled them, and in this particular instance, it took a lot to get Elon Musk to come around and eventually ban this, which he did. But what if you have actors that do generate this technology and don't care? That's the world we're entering. And yes, women are absolutely very much in the firing line.
Yeah, I mean, obviously men are too, but you certainly haven't seen people suggesting that men are stripped down to their underwear or nothing and subjected to threats of rape. Is that right?
Well, this was an example where it was used to sexualize women against their consent. Mm. Like, let's never forget that, against their consent for doing something completely normal, which is participating in an online conversation about whatever they wanted to be participating in. And by the way, this wasn't necessarily women in power. I saw a lot of politicians have this done to them, of course, but it was a lot of just normal girls. I mean, that's awful.
Yeah.
If you ever thought to kind of encourage normal women into public office or even leadership.
Just putting their hands up in some form of public
behaviour.
Correct.
Why would they when this happens to them for doing nothing?
You know, I remember, we do feel it's a long way the listeners might remember the appalling abuse by Larry Pickering, the late Larry Pickering, the cartoonist on Julia Gillard, when she was Prime Minister. And I remember the shock, and people were sort of, you know, don't go there, don't look, it's so revolting. I mean, eventually he was outed. And I mean, I think it dogged, and it should have, the last days of his life. But that was such a shocking event all those years ago, and we do seem to be in a different world now, which is what makes the two guests I'm about to welcome sort of so appropriate. Dr. Julie Pizzetti is an Australian journalist and academic who led the UN landmark Tipping Point study. Now, that looked at the rise and impact of gendered abuse on democracies around the world. And Bronnie Taylor's with us too. She's a former New South Wales Nationals Minister for Women. She now sits on the Political Advisory Board of Women for Election. That's an Australian advocacy group fighting for better female representation in democracy, which I think everybody sort of wants. So how are they affected, both of them, by this trend that seems to be underway? Here they are now. Bronnie and Julie, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Geraldine. It's great to be here.
Yeah, now, fantastic.
You're both in Canberra. What are you up to exactly?
I'm in Australia for a few weeks doing some work focused on technology-facilitated gender-based violence, as it's referred to in the UN system. And that has involved speaking to parliamentarians. It's involved speaking to NGOs, women in leadership organisations, and discussing the research that I lead for UN Women and research that's funded by the UK government focused on the escalating crisis of online violence against women in public life.
Look, you spent quite a lot of time, Bronnie, in public life. Did you cop a lot of abuse?
Yes, I did. But it really escalated towards the end of my term and really when I became a minister. And I look at what's happening now and, look, I've been out of the New South Wales State Parliament, be 2 years in October, and I can see the increase and I can see what's happening to the people I care about on both sides. And particularly, I think it's exacerbated in local government where there's a lot less sort of protection and support than there would be for state members. And then federal members, I think, even get a little bit more. But what I don't want to see is I just don't want to see women not wanting to put their hand up for these roles, because I think that it will really transcend down to all areas. I mean, people won't want to put themselves on the local preschool committee, you know, in country New South Wales where I live, because of all of this that's going on. So I'm just here because I'm a member of the Advisory Board for Women for Election. It's something I feel really strongly about. And I think we need to tell our stories and we need to make sure that we can get some solutions.
Can you tell me exactly what we're dealing with? And when you talk of an escalating crisis, what does that mean? What has escalated? Is it the tempo of abuse or is it the type of abuse?
It's both. So speaking about the work that I've led at the international level, we can see both an increase in frequency of attacks, we see an increase in the severity of impacts, and we see shifting modes of the delivery of what we're talking about here is online violence, which is online harassment, abuse, threats, and involves digital security breaches, and it also involves what we refer to as gender disinformation. So it's a combination of those features of attack.
Well, what does gender disinformation mean? I'm not familiar with that term. What exactly does that constitute materially as?
It constitutes as disinformation, which is used in combination with misogyny to target an individual.
I mean, what do they say? Well, what do they actually say?
So a manifestation of this would be, let me give you the example of my current boss, Maria Ressa, who's a Nobel laureate, who's one of the early cases that I studied. She was falsely accused of being a criminal in combination with highly sexualized abuse and threats of sexual violence. And the gender disinformation piece is calling her, you know, a queen of fake news, for example. That's just one very clear example of what this looks like. But the objective is to blend disinformational tactics, false information, with sexualized attacks on women in public life. And the objective is to undercut their credibility, whether they're women reporters or women in elected office. That's the specific objective. But let me get to two aspects of this, which demonstrate the ways in which the crisis is escalating. So one is the political environment, rising authoritarianism, the decline in liberal democracies around the world, where we see attacks on the rule of law and human rights-based systems. And at the same time, we've seen the mainstreaming of generative AI, which has resulted in some of the very recent manifestations of this problem, including nudification apps that allow for the much cheaper, much easier, much quicker production of what are known as deep fakes, depicting women in pornographic positions that are actually indistinguishable now from real images or real videos of women. And so that has really supercharged the threat environment for women in public life. And I can give you some examples of what that looks like.
Frightening. If you would, please, because I think it's amazing how many people still do put their hands up, don't they? So maybe they don't believe it's going to happen to them.
Yeah, I mean, look, my observation after being in Australia for a month is that there is significant evidence that this is a problem in Australia. There is less willingness to speak about it publicly, it seems. So the example I'll give you relates to a very recent episode in the UK involving a British MP, a Labour MP called Jess Asato, who was campaigning for a ban on nudification apps. Now, these apps have been around for a while, but what changed late last year was that with the release of Grok enabling nudification, Grok is Elon Musk's AI tool, and the seamless integration of that tool with his distribution platform, which is X. And so suddenly we're seeing nudification go viral. So images falsifying women naked in posed positions, video animations of women who've been subjected to this synthetic depiction that's impossible to distinguish from reality. And in Jess Asato's case, she's campaigning for a ban on these nudification apps. And she found herself being targeted, both depicted wearing bikini, lingerie, whatever. Then, as she ramped up her campaign and continued to speak out against this technique and the impacts on women, she found herself being portrayed in deepfake videos, naked, and in one instance, in a reply to a tweet from Elon Musk, another user generated a deepfake that showed her being chloroformed in preparation for rape. I mean, that's the level of threat that women in public life now face. And what I want to talk about too, and hope we can come back to it, is the connection between these online harms and the threat of offline violence. It's a really dangerous trajectory.
Do you know who's doing it? Are the perpetrators changing?
I think often, you know, you do know because you have the same sort of people that appear on your feed or doing things. I think particularly for rural and regional people like myself, you do tend to know because it's a smaller town and so you're running into them all the time and everybody's knowing it and they're sort of targeting the same people. But I think as well in terms of women and when you're in parliament and when this is happening to you, of course you talk about it, you know, with your colleagues and with each other. But, you know, there's a great saying that we used to use when I was a nurse, and that actually said, don't let abnormal become normal. So when you talk about, I don't know, having a lump in your breast, for example, and, you know, suddenly it's been there for 6 months, it's sort of then, oh, it's a little bit bigger, but it's actually abnormal, it's not normal. And I think because it's happening all the time, they're thinking, oh, that's happening to Natalie, or that's happening to my friend Sarah, or that's happening to this person that I'm in parliament with. You know, we just get on with it and it's part of what's happening. And I think when we look at, yes, we've had a great increase and the Labor Party's done a terrific job in Australia federally of getting that equity in parliament, but I don't think we're seeing the results of this yet. And this will be in the women who are deciding to run in the next sort of lot in the next 5 to 10 years that will look at that and think, do I want my family exposed to seeing that video of me? Do I want my 13-year-old son and his mate sharing that and having a giggle and him coming home and telling me, what is this, Mum? This is the reality of what we're faced with, and but people won't do it.
I mean, I remember looking at this a few years ago, and there was a great deal of focus on young men, particularly young men sitting quietly at home who would never behave like that outside the anonymity of the web. Now, is that still the understanding, the same sort of utterly dysfunctional, deeply immature type of carry-on?
It's much more sophisticated than it used to be, Geraldine. Mm. So I think we still see elements of that kind of behaviour, and there's evidence from research undertaken by others demonstrating the ways in which young men in particular are being radicalised through misogynistic networks online. In fact, you know, misogyny is one of the top indicators for radicalisation and extremism now, and we're seeing that pattern reflected internationally, and we're seeing security services expressing significant concern about that. So that is still a reality. However, we now see bot networks operating much more effectively, much more human-like, and it becomes much harder to determine what is a coordinated bot attack, what is a coordinated attack involving both human actors and bots, and what is some, you know, misogynistic dude sitting in his mother's basement. Yeah. But nevertheless, you know, the misogyny is a thread that cuts through all this. And we're talking about gender disinformation. One of the other things we see is that in coordinated disinformation campaigns, which sometimes involve foreign state actors, sometimes are domestically run, we see misogyny being used as part of a strategy to seed disinformation narratives that are designed to undercut public trust in, you know, critical independent journalism or public institutions, in government.
Can you trace who's doing it? I've always wondered.
Yes.
Can you?
Yeah. So look, in the past 5 years, my team and I have been working on the development of what we call an early warning system for online violence. And we've identified these 16 indicators, we call them, that signal the increase of risk associated with offline harm in an attack. And so we actually use AI to, at scale, analyse the messages and to do the network analysis that helps us to understand which accounts are involved and to then be able to investigate who's behind those accounts. So yes, it is possible. And do you know what, Geraldine? We're doing this on the smell of an oily rag. The platforms have the ability, they have the technology, they have the billions of dollars to be able to create these systems and to deploy them and to ensure that the algorithms are actually tuned for protection and preservation of democracy and human rights, but instead it's outsourced to people like us.
Okay. And what are you finding? Where is it coming from?
I mean, it depends on who's being targeted. We've published what we call big data case studies focused on women journalists, about 8 now, I think, internationally. And we see there that there's evidence of coordinated attacks connected to foreign state actors. We see examples of authoritarian...
So you're sure of that? So we've got we've got the usual suspects. There are, you know, the usual suspects involved.
Which ones?
Yes. In some, I mean, look, these are in individual cases, right? But we have seen evidence in the case of the journalist Khada Uess, who was the premier Al Jazeera anchor in Arabic. We have seen evidence of Saudi administration-associated accounts. And it's not just us documenting this. This has now been reported by former UN Special Rapporteur on Freedom of Expression. In Maria Ress's case, we saw evidence of China-linked attacks. So this is known. I think what has been overlooked, though, is the ways in which aspirant authoritarians within a state, within a country, will also target and attack women in public life in their own midst as part of their own political projects.
You're listening to Global Roaming with me, Latika Burke, and Geraldine Duke. We're joined by academic Dr. Julie Pizzetti and former New South Wales MP Bronnie Taylor, and we're talking about the impact of the abuse of women in public life. And do we have any evidence about how much effect this is having on women wanting to put their hands up for public office or indeed any public-facing job?
Well, I think what's happened recently, you know, Women for Election have done this survey, and in this survey they've found that it absolutely is affecting the way people do their jobs. And we were talking to two young female deputy mayors yesterday in a panel that we did in Sydney, and they were saying it's definitely changing their behaviour. It's definitely changing the way that they do things. Well, they're not wanting to go out as much on their own. They're feeling threatened if they go on their own, if they know that person is there, so they may not turn up to an event, or they may not engage with their constituents like they used to. You know, a really great thing was raised by the professor from ANU yesterday about one of the things that people do feel empowered to do is to be able to block, right? So you just block and you block often. Mm. But then that actually affects democracy too, because, you know, you don't want to block anyone that's critical. You want to hear all of those, particularly as a politician, because you want to know what the issues are. And so you want to know what the arguments are and the things that you can do about it.
Bronnie, I was struck by what you said quite casually about country, you know, country, rural and regional, where people are walking down the streets and they know who's doing this. I think I heard you correctly.
Yeah, I'm spot on.
Well, that's pretty, I mean, in its own way, that's sort of maybe less terrifying in a way. It's, do you not see it like that?
I don't, and I don't from my own personal experience, Geraldine. I think it would be amusing if, you know, we felt that we were protected or we felt that the system allowed for you to be protected from those people. But for me, it's been terrible. People have felt threatened and people have driven past homes. You know, this person's arrived at people's homes. And at the end of the day, Geraldine, like, I reached the highest level of politics in New South Wales. So, you know, I've got to be pretty strong, right? And I mean, I can handle myself, I believe, pretty well. But that doesn't mean that when someone turns up to have a go at you and they're physically bigger and physically stronger, that you don't feel vulnerable.
Well, I just wonder, how much do you fear? Because in the UK, we've had several MPs assassinated, two of them women over the decade, Jo Cox in 2016, and allegedly Anne Widdecombe may have been assassinated in an attack this year. She's a Reform member. Did it reach this scale for you? And do you think that this, in the UK, which is usually pretty peaceful, do you think that this reflects a normalisation of what's said online, creeping into radicalisation and then offline action turning into real physical violence?
I do, Latika. Like, I'm really fearful of that. And I feel that someone can push and push and it takes one point for them to break. Mm. And it takes one point for people that something just flicks. We've seen it happen time and time again.
Yeah.
And when you see what's happened in the UK and, you know, Julie was, you know, giving a talk yesterday and talked about those women, do I fear that here that it will happen? Of course I do, because often we tend to follow what's happening in those jurisdictions. And the more it gets normalised and the more that this happens, that the likelihood of it happening here, I think, only increases.
And I just want to add to that too. I mean, we have evidence to support that thesis, Latika. So this survey that we conducted for UN Women at the end of 2025 focused on women in public life. We found that around 45% of them had experienced offline attacks that they said was seeded online. So this speaks to the trajectory.
And how do we sit this within the context of what looks like broader political violence? Because we've had in the UK the assassination of David Amos, a man. In the US, obviously the assassination of Charlie Kirk. Are we seeing a rise in political violence generally, and female targeting is higher as a concentration? How do you begin to try and unpick that?
I mean, political violence is increasing empirically. It's increasing. And the enabling environment, I would argue, and I'm not alone in doing this, involves the weaponization of social media and mm-hmm. AI tools and the abrogation of responsibility on the part of the companies for dealing with a business model that's built on algorithms that drive division, partisanship and also polarisation. And that's what leads to an environment where political violence is effectively being licensed. And that's not helped by authoritarian political leaders who are triggering pylons through their comments, you know, offline.
Okay, there's a lot wrapped up in here that is clearly societal and we can't expect to solve in one day. But what solutions are available to us to mitigate this, and who are you asking to resolve certain things? Where is it that you're asking tech platforms to do things? What do you require from governments?
Look, I think in terms of government, you know, Australia has led the way, and I think we should really be proud of that in terms of the government answered a real concern that was coming from parents, say, about, you know, children under 16 and the effect that it was having on their mental health. But I also think as well that we need to ask government to provide greater protections, our official systems, so court systems. You know, I think taking 3 months to hear an AVO, it's really unacceptable. It needs to be faster so that that can be actioned. And I think that if we had more support and protection so that we knew when we reported it, something would happen and that it wouldn't have to escalate to the point where you were actually harmed, I think that would be a really good starting point.
Yeah. And I think just based on the work at the international level and what might be helpful for Australian legislators and regulators is, one, recognising misogynistic hate crimes as hate crimes, recognising misogynistic hate speech as hate speech. One of the problems that the authorities have, the regulator has, in trying to intervene in the context of gender-based online violence that doesn't rise to the level of an immediate threat to their safety of the woman, so which doesn't involve a threat of rape or death or attacks on their children, for example, is that it's difficult to act against that in the case of adult women. There are avenues that have been pursued because there are certain protections.
What, is there, are there no appropriate legal ramifications?
No. So, I mean, under the anti-discrimination law in this country, you know, there is appropriate protection, for example, for race-based abuse, for sexual orientation-based abuse, in some cases, perhaps for gender identity-based abuse. That's an international example. What we have found is real gaps globally, and they exist in Australia too, with regard to the protections that could be leveraged if misogyny was recognised as a form of hate. The other thing that's really important, I think, and that Australia could take a leading role in doing, is regulating technology and tech platforms and AI as products. So bringing in product liability perspectives here. We've seen success with getting the platforms to act in the US in very recent cases. And the companies are required through these judgments to not just pay fines because of the known risks associated with their products, but to design or redesign their technologies to prevent them being used for harm in the first instance. Right. So I keep saying, you know, we're in Australia, we're known internationally as the nanny state because we love rules and we love our safety talk. So how is it that if we can't let a toaster that blows up upon plunging a piece of bread into it from hitting the market, we're not prepared to accept that, how do we actually allow technologies that have been established through whistleblower testimony and other evidence and research over many years now to be inflicting harm, to be released without any appropriate, you know, assessments?
We shall leave that as a very important open question. Thank you. Thank you, Julie Pizzetti and Bronnie Taylor. We really appreciate your time.
Thanks so much.
Thanks,
it was really lovely chatting.
That was Australian journalist and academic Dr. Julie Pizzetti, who's normally based in Oxford in the UK, and Bronnie Taylor, a former New South Wales Nationals Minister for Women. Now, I want to know basically your response to that, Latika, whether you're optimistic that things can change or whether it makes you more sort of, you know, oppressed.
I think it's just one of the things that we are grappling with since the advent of social media. You know, I was reflecting back during that chat. We started out so innocent about what social media would do for us and what it would offer us. And now I think 2 decades on, we're seeing all these malevolent factors that I don't know we really thought too much about before we unleashed this on our social lives, on our democracies and on our culture. And here we are now trying to put certain things back in the bottle. I'm not massively sure how much we can put in the bottle, Geraldine, but certainly this radicalization and normalization of very angry online commentary that moves or has the capacity to move into the online world, I think it's terrifying. And I do think it's really, really real. We have seen this in the UK. We see it overseas. God help us if it happens at home.
I will be very keen to hear how our listeners feel, so do keep your questions and feedback coming. Our email is global.roaming@abc.net.au. I'd like to thank today producer Aston Brown, supervising producer Pat Sunderland, and executive producer Laura McAuliffe. Hamish and I will be back with you tomorrow, and we'll be joined by Peter Garrett, the former frontman, as you probably know, do I need to say, of Midnight Oil. He was a Labor politician, but he's now chairing this public inquiry into AUKUS as a very interesting effort to decide how one gets things onto public agendas that some people believe ought to be part of public debate, and others say, oh, look, you know, let it go. So that's what we're going to wrestle with tomorrow. Bye-bye for now.
See you, Geraldine.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.